He thought of the cur's dark eyes, saved from stupidity by the single, malevolent spark. God knew how the dog had gotten into that Polaroid world in the first place, but when its picture was taken, it could see out, and it wanted to get out. And Kevin believed in his heart that it wanted to kill him first. The thing it was wearing around its neck said it wanted to kill him first, proclaimed that it wanted to kill him first. But after that, why, after Kevin, anyone would do, anyone at all. In a way, it was like another game you played when you were a little kid, wasn't it? It was like Giant Step. The dog had been walking along the fence. The dog had heard the Polaroid, that squidgy little whine. It turned and saw what? Its own world or universe? A world or universe enough like its own so it saw or sensed it could or at least might be able to live and hunt here? It didn't matter. Now, every time someone took a picture of it, the dog would get closer. It would get closer and closer until, well, until what? Until it burst through somehow? That's stupid, he muttered. It'd never fit. What? His father asked, roused from his own musings. Nothing, Kevin said. I was just thinking to myself. Then, from downstairs, muffled but audible, they heard Pop Merrill cry out in mingled dismay, irritation, and surprise.
Well, ship fire and save matches, goddammit!
Kevin and his father looked at each other, startled. Let's go see what happened, his father said, and got up. I hope he didn't fall down and break his arm or something. I mean, part of me does hope it, but, you know. Kevin thought, what if he's been taking pictures? What if that dog's down there? It hadn't sounded like fear in the old man's voice, and of course there really was no way a dog that looked as big as a medium-sized German shepherd could come through either a camera the size of the Sun's 660 or one of the prints it made. You might as well try to drag a washing machine through a knothole. Still, he felt fear enough for both of them, for all three of them, as he followed his father back down the stairs to the gloomy bazaar below. Going down the stairs, Pop Merrill was as happy as a clam at high tide. He had been prepared to make the switch right in front of them if he had to. Might have been a problem if it had just been the boy, who was still a year or so away from thinking he knew everything. But the boy's dad? Ah, fooling that fine fellow would have been like stealing a bottle from a baby. Had he told the boy about the jam he'd gotten into that time? From the way the boy looked at him, a new, cautious way, Pop thought Delavan probably had. And what else had the father told the son? Well, let's see. Does he let you call him Pop? That means he's planning to pull a fast one on you. That was for starters. He's a low-down snake in the grass, son. That was for seconds. And of course, there was the prize of them all. Let me do the talking, boy. I know him better than you do. You just let me handle everything. Men like Delavan were to Pop Merrill what a nice platter of fried chicken was to some folks. Tender, tasty, juicy, and all but falling off the bone. Once Delavan had been little more than a kid himself, and he would never fully understand that it wasn't Pop who had stuck his tit in the ringer, but he himself. The man could have gone to his wife, and she would have tapped that old biddy aunt of hers whose tight little ass was lined with $100 bills, and Delavan would have spent some time in the doghouse, but she would have let him out in time. He not only hadn't seen it that way, he hadn't seen it at all. And now, for no reason but idiot time, which came and went without any help from anyone, he thought he knew all there was to know about Reginald Marion Merrill, which was just the way Pop liked it. Why, he could have swapped one camera for the other right in front of the man, and Delavan never would have seen a goddamn thing. That was how sure he was that he had old Pop figured out. But this was better. You never, ever asked Lady Luck for a date. She had a way of standing men up just when they needed her the most. But if she showed up on her own, well, it was wise to drop whatever it was you were doing and take her out and wine her and dine her just as lavishly as you could. That was one bitch you always put out for you if you treated her right. So he went quickly to the work table, bent and extracted the Polaroid 660 with the broken lens from the shadows underneath. He put it on the table, fished a key ring from his pocket, with one quick glance over his shoulder to be sure neither of them had decided to come down after all, and selected the small key which opened the locked drawer that formed the entire left side of the table. In this deep drawer were a number of gold Krugerrands, a stamp album in which the least valuable stamp was worth $600 in the latest Scott stamp catalog, a coin collection worth approximately $19,000, 2 dozen glossy photographs of a bleary-eyed woman having sexual congress with a Shetland pony, and an amount of cash totaling just over $2,000. The cash, which he stowed in a variety of tin cans, was Pop's loan-out money. John Delavan would have recognized the bills. They were all crumpled tens. Pop deposited Kevin's son's 660 in this drawer, locked it, and put his keyring back in his pocket. Then he pushed the camera with the broken lens off the edge of the work table again and cried out,
"Well, shit fire and save matches, goddammit!"
loud enough for them to hear. Then he arranged his face in the proper expression of dismay and chagrin and waited for them to come running to see what had happened.
"Pop," Kevin cried, "Mr. Merrill, are you okay?"
"Yeah," he said. "Didn't hurt nothing but my goddamn pride. That camera's just bad luck, I guess. I bent over to open the tool drawer, is what I mean to say, and I knocked the fucking thing right off onto the floor. Only I guess it didn't come through so well this time. I don't know if I should say I'm sorry or not. I mean, you was gonna..."
He held the camera apologetically out to Kevin, who took it, looked at the broken lens and shattered plastic of the housing around it.
"No, it's okay," Kevin told him, turning the camera over in his hands.
But he did not handle it in the same gingerly, tentative way he had before, as if it might really be constructed not of plastic and glass, but of some sort of explosive.
"I meant to bust it up anyhow.
Guess I saved you the trouble."
"I'd feel better," Kevin began.
Well, I feel the same way about mice. Laugh if you want to, but when I catch one in a trap and it's dead, I beat it with a broom anyway, just to be sure, is what I mean to say."
Kevin smiled faintly, then looked at his father.
"He said he's got a chopping block out back, Dad.
Got a pretty good sledge in the shed, too, if ain't nobody took it."
"Do you mind, Dad?"
"It's your camera, Kev," Delavan said. He flicked a distrustful glance at Pop, but it was a glance that said he distrusted Pop on general principles and not for any specific reason.
"But if it will make you feel any better, I think it's the right decision."
"Good," Kevin said. He felt a tremendous weight go off his shoulders. No, it was from his heart that the weight was lifted. With the lens broken, the camera was surely useless. But he wouldn't feel really at ease until he saw it in fragments around Pop's chopping block. He turned it over in his hands, front to back, and back to front, amused and amazed at how much he liked the broken way it looked and felt.
"I think I owe you the cost of that camera, Delavan,"
Pop said, knowing exactly how the man would respond.
"No," Delavan said. "Let's smash it and forget this whole crazy thing ever happened."
He paused. "I almost forgot. We were going to look at those last few photos under your magnifying glass. I wanted to see if I could make out the thing the dog's wearing. I keep thinking it looks familiar."
"We can do that after we get rid of the camera, can't we?"
Kevin asked.
"Okay, Dad?"
"Sure."
"And then,"
Pop said,
"it might not be such a bad idea to burn the pictures themselves. You could do it right in my stove."
"I think that's a great idea," Kevin said. "What do you think, Dad?"
"I think Mrs. Merrill never raised any fools," his father said.
"Well,"
Pop said, smiling enigmatically from behind folds of rising blue smoke,
"there was 5 of us, you know."
The day had been bright blue when Kevin and his father walked down to the Emporium Galorium, a perfect autumn day. Now it was 4:30. The sky had mostly clouded over, and it looked like it might rain before dark. The first real chill of the fall touched Kevin's hands.
It would chap them red if he stayed out long enough. But he had no plans to. His mom would be home in half an hour, and already he wondered what she would say when she saw Dad was with him, and what his dad would say. But that was for later. Kevin set the Sun 660 on the chopping block in the little backyard, and Pop Merrill handed him a sledgehammer. The haft was worn smooth with usage. The head was rusty, as if someone had left it carelessly out in the rain, not once or twice, but many times. Yet it would do the job all right. Kevin had no doubt of that. The Polaroid, its lens broken and most of the housing around it shattered as well, looked fragile and defenseless sitting there on the block's chipped, chunked, and splintered surface, where you expected to see a length of ash or maple waiting to be split in two. Kevin set his hands on the sledgehammer's smooth handle and tightened them. "You're sure, son?" Mr. Delavan asked. "Yes." "Okay." Kevin's father glanced at his own watch. "Do it, then." Pop stood to one side, with his pipe clamped between his wretched teeth, hands in his back pockets. He looked shrewdly from the boy to the man, and then back to the boy, but said nothing. Kevin lifted the sledgehammer, and suddenly, surprised by an anger at the camera he hadn't even known he felt, he brought it down with all the force he could muster. "Too hard," he thought. "You're going to miss it. Be lucky enough to mash your own foot, and there it will sit, not much more than a piece of hollow plastic a little kid could stomp flat without half trying. And even if you're lucky enough to miss your foot, Pop will look at you. He won't say anything. He won't have to. It'll all be in the way he looks at you." And he thought also, "It doesn't matter if I hit it or not. It's magic, some kind of magic camera, and you can't break it. Even if you hit it dead on the money, the sledge will just bounce off it like bullets off Superman's chest." But then, there was no more time to think anything, because the sledge connected squarely with the camera. Kevin really had swung much too hard to maintain anything resembling control. But he got lucky, and the sledgehammer didn't just bounce back up, maybe hitting Kevin square between the eyes and killing him, like the final twist in a horror story. The Sun didn't so much shatter as detonate. Black plastic flew everywhere. A long rectangle with a shiny black square at one end, a picture which would never be taken, Kevin supposed, fluttered to the bare ground beside the chopping block and lay there, face down. There was a moment of silence so complete they could hear not only the cars on Lower Main Street, but kids playing tag half a block away in the parking lot behind Wardell's Country Store, which had gone bankrupt 2 years before and had stood vacant ever since.
"Well, that's that," Pop said. "You swung that sledge just like Paul Bunyan, Kevin. I should smile and kiss a pig if you didn't. No need to do that," he said,
now addressing Mr. Delavan, who was picking up broken chunks of plastic as prissily as a man picking up the pieces of a glass he has accidentally knocked to the floor and shattered.
"I have a boy comes in and cleans up the yard every week or two. I know it don't look like much as it is, but if I didn't have that kid, glory."
"Then maybe we ought to use your magnifying glass and take a look at those pictures," Mr. Delavan said, standing up. He dropped the few pieces of plastic he had picked up into a rusty incinerator that stood nearby and then brushed off his hands.
"Fine by me,"
Pop said.
"Then burn them," Kevin reminded. "Don't forget that."
"I didn't,"
Pop said.
"I'll feel better when they're gone, too."
"Jesus,"
John Delavan said. He was bending over Pop Merrill's work table, looking through the lighted magnifying glass at the second-to-last photograph. It was the one in which the object around the dog's neck showed most clearly. In the last photo, the object had swung back in the other direction again.
"Kevin, look at that and tell me if it's what I think it is."
Kevin took the magnifying glass and looked. He had known, of course. But even so, it still wasn't a look just for form's sake. Clyde Tombaugh must have looked at an actual photograph of the planet Pluto for the first time with the same fascination. Tombaugh had known it was there, calculations showing similar distortions in the orbital paths of Neptune and Uranus had made Pluto not just a possibility but a necessity. Still, to know a thing was there, even to know what it was, that did not detract from the fascination of actually seeing it for the first time. He let go of the switch and handed the glass back to Pop.
"Yeah," he said to his father, "it's what you think it is.
His voice was as flat as the things in that Polaroid world, he supposed, and he felt an urge to laugh. He kept the sound inside, not because it would have been inappropriate to laugh, although he supposed it would have been, but because the sound would have come out sounding, well, flat. Pop waited, and when it became clear to him that they were going to need a nudge, he said,
"Well, don't keep me hopping from one foot to the other. What the hell is it?"
Kevin had felt reluctant to tell him before, and he felt reluctant now. There was no reason for it, but...
"Stop being so goddamn dumb. He helped you when you needed helping, no matter how he earns his dough. Tell him and burn the pictures and let's get out of here before all those clocks start striking five."
Yes, if he was around when that happened, he thought it would be the final touch. He would just go completely bananas, and they could cart him away to Juniper Hill, raving about real dogs and Polaroid worlds and cameras that took the same picture over and over again, except not quite. "The Polaroid camera was a birthday present," he heard himself saying in that same dry voice. "What it's wearing around its neck was another one." Pop slowly pushed his glasses up onto his bald head and squinted at Kevin.
"I don't guess I'm following you, son."
"I have an aunt," Kevin said. "Actually, she's my great-aunt, but we're not supposed to call her that because she says it makes her feel old. Aunt Hilda. Anyway, Aunt Hilda's husband left her a lot of money. My mom says she's worth over $1 million, but she's a tightwad." He stopped, leaving his father space to protest. But his father only smiled sourly and nodded. Pop Merrill, who knew all about that situation... There was not, in truth, much in Castle Rock and the surrounding areas Pop didn't know at least something about. Simply held his peace and waited for the boy to get around to spilling it. "She comes and spends Christmas with us once every 3 years, and that's about the only time we go to church because she goes to church. We have lots of broccoli when Aunt Hilda comes. None of us like it, and it just about makes my sister puke, but Aunt Hilda likes broccoli a lot, so we have it. There was a book on our summer reading list, Great Expectations. And there was a lady in it who was just like Aunt Hilda. She got her kicks dangling her money in front of her relatives. Her name was Miss Havisham. And when Miss Havisham said frog, people jumped. We jump, and I guess the rest of our family does, too." "Oh, your Uncle Randy makes your mother look like a piker," Mr. Delavan said unexpectedly. Kevin thought his dad meant it to sound amused in a cynical sort of way, but what came through was a deep, acidic bitterness. "When Aunt Hilda says frog in Randy's house, they all just about turn cartwheels over the roof beams." "Anyway," Kevin told Pop, "she sends me the same thing for my birthday every year. I mean, each one is different, but each one's really the same."
"What is it she sends you, boy?"
"A string tie," Kevin said. "Like the kind you see guys wearing in old-time country music bands. It has something different on the clasp every year, but it's always a string tie." Pop snatched the magnifying glass and bent over the picture with it.
"Stone the crows," he said, straightening up. "A string tie. That's just what it is. Now, how come I didn't see that?"
"Because it isn't the sort of thing a dog would wear around his neck, I guess," Kevin said in that same wooden voice. They had been here only 45 minutes or so, but he felt as if he had aged another 15 years.
"The thing to remember," his mind told him over and over, "is that the camera's gone. It's nothing but splinters. Never mind all the king's horses and all the king's men. Not even all the guys who work making cameras at the Polaroid factory in Schenectady could put that baby back together again."
Yes, and thank God, because this was the end of the line. As far as Kevin was concerned, if he never encountered the supernatural again until he was 80, never so much as brushed up against it, it would be too soon. "Also, it's very small," Mr. Delavan pointed out. "I was there when Kevin took it out of the box, and we all knew what it was going to be. The only mystery was what would be on the clasp this year. We joked about it."
"What is on the clasp?"
Pop asked, peering into the photograph again, or peering at it anyway. Kevin would testify in any court in the land that peering into a Polaroid was simply impossible. "A bird," Kevin said. "I'm pretty sure it's a woodpecker. And that's what the dog in the picture is wearing around its neck. A string tie with a woodpecker on the clasp."
"Jesus," Pop said.
He was, in his own quiet way, one of the world's finer actors. But there was no need to simulate the surprise he felt now. Mr. Delavan abruptly swept all the Polaroids together. "Let's put these goddamn things in the wood stove," he said. When Kevin and his father got home, it was 10 minutes past five and starting to drizzle. Mrs. Delavan's 2-year-old Toyota was not in the driveway. But she had been and gone. There was a note from her on the kitchen table, held down by the salt and pepper shakers. When Kevin unfolded the note, a $10 bill fell out. "Dear Kevin, at the bridge game, Jane Doyen asked if Meg and I would like to have dinner with her at Bonanza, as her husband is off to Pittsburgh on business, and she's knocking around the house alone. I said we'd be delighted. Meg, especially. You know how much she likes to be one of the girls. I hope you don't mind eating in solitary splendor. Why not order a pizza and some soda for yourself, and your father can order for himself when he gets home. He doesn't like reheated pizza, and you know he'll want a couple of beers. Love you, Mom." They looked at each other, both saying, "Well, there's one thing we don't have to worry about," without having to say it out loud. Apparently, neither she nor Meg had noticed that Mr. Delavan's car was still in the garage. "Do you want me to—" Kevin began, but there was no need to finish because his father cut across him. "Yes, check, right now." Kevin went up the stairs by twos and into his room. He had a bureau and a desk. The bottom desk drawer was full of what Kevin simply thought of as stuff. Things it would have seemed somehow criminal to throw away, although he had no real use for any of them. There was his grandfather's pocket watch, heavy, scrolled, magnificent, and so badly rusted that the jeweler in Lewiston he and his mother had brought it to only took one look, shook his head, and pushed it back across the counter. There were two sets of matching cufflinks and two orphans, a penthouse gatefold, a paperback book called Gross Jokes, and a Sony Walkman, which had for some reason developed a habit of eating the tapes it was supposed to play. It was just stuff, that was all. There was no other word that fit. Part of the stuff, of course, was the 13 string ties Aunt Hilda had sent him for his last 13 birthdays. He took them out one by one, counted, came up with 12 instead of 13, rooted through the stuff drawer again, then counted again. Still 12. "Not there?" Kevin, who had been squatting, cried out and leaped to his feet. "I'm sorry," Mr. Delavan said from the doorway. "That was dumb." "That's okay," Kevin said. He wondered briefly how fast a person's heart could beat before the person in question simply blew his engine. "I'm just on edge. Stupid." "It's not." His father looked at him soberly. "When I saw that tape, I got so scared I felt like maybe I'd have to reach into my mouth and push my stomach back down with my fingers." Kevin looked at his father gratefully. "It's not there, is it?" Mr. Delavan asked. "The one with the woodpecker or whatever in hell it was supposed to be." "No, it's not." "Did you keep the camera in that drawer?" Kevin nodded his head slowly. "Pop, Mr. Merrill said to let it rest every so often. That was part of the schedule he made out." Something tugged briefly at his mind. Was gone. "So I stuck it in there." "Boy," Mr. Delavan said softly. "Yeah." They looked at each other in the gloom, and then suddenly Kevin smiled. It was like watching the sun burst through a raft of clouds. "What?" "I was remembering how I felt," Kevin said. "I swung that sledgehammer so hard." Mr. Delavan began to smile, too. "I thought you were going to take off your own damn—" "And when it hit, it made this crunch sound. Flew every damn which way. Boom!" Kevin finished. "Gone!" They began to laugh together in Kevin's room, and Kevin found he was almost glad all this had happened. The sense of relief was as inexpressible and yet as perfect as the sensation one feels when, either by happy accident or by some psychic guidance, another person manages to scratch that one itchy place on one's back that one cannot scratch oneself, hitting it exactly. Bang, on the money, making it wonderfully worse for a single second by the simple touch, pressure, arrival of those fingers, and then, oh, blessed relief. It was like that with the camera and with his father's knowing.
It's gone, Kevin said. Isn't it?
As gone as Hiroshima after the Enola Gay dropped the A-bomb on it, Mr. Delavan replied, and then added, smashed to shit is what I mean to say.
Kevin gawped at his father, and then burst into helpless peals, screams almost of laughter. His father joined him. They ordered a loaded pizza shortly after. When Mary and Meg Delavan arrived home at 7:20, they both still had the giggles.
Well, you two look like you've been up to no good,
Mrs. Delavan said, a little puzzled. There was something in their hilarity that struck the woman's center of her, that deep part which the sex seems to tap into fully only in times of childbirth and disaster, as a little unhealthy. They looked and sounded like men who may have just missed having a car accident.
Want to let the ladies in on it?
Just two bachelors having a good time, Mr. Delavan said.
Smashing good time, Kevin amplified, to which his father added, is what we mean to say. And they looked at each other and were howling again. Meg, honestly bewildered, looked at her mother and said,
why are they doing that, Mom?
Mrs. Delavan said, because they have penises, dear. Go hang up your coat. Bob Merrill let the Delavans, pair a feast, out and then locked the door behind them. He turned off all the lights, save for the one over the work table, produced his keys, and opened his own stuffed drawer. From it, he took Kevin Delavan's Polaroid Sun 660, chipped but otherwise undamaged, and looked at it fixedly. It had scared both the father and the son. That was clear enough to Pop. It had scared him as well, and still did. But to put a thing like this on a block and smash it to smithereens, that was crazy. There was a way to turn a buck on this goddamn thing. There always was. Pop locked it away in the drawer. He would sleep on it, and by the morning he would know how to proceed. In truth, he already had a pretty goddamn good idea. He got up, snapped off the work light, and wove his way through the gloom toward the steps leading up to his apartment. He moved with the unthinking, sure-footed grace of long practice. Halfway there, he stopped. He felt an urge, an amazingly strong urge, to go back and look at the camera again. What in God's name for? He didn't even have any film for the Christless thing. Not that he had any intentions of taking any pictures with it. If someone else wanted to take snapshots, watch that dog's progress, the buyer was welcome. Caveat emperor, as he always said. Let the goddamn emperor caveat or not as it suited him. As for him, he'd as soon go into a cage filled with lions without even a goddamn whip and chair. Still, leave it, he said roughly in the darkness, and the sound of his own voice startled him and got him moving, and he went upstairs without another look back. Very early the next morning, Kevin Delavan had a nightmare so horrible he could only remember parts of it, like isolated phrases of music heard on a radio with a defective speaker. He was walking into a grungy little mill town. Apparently he was on the bum because he had a pack on his back. The name of the town was Oatley, and Kevin had the idea it was either in Vermont or upstate New York. You know anyone hiring here in Oatley? He asked an old man pushing a shopping cart along a cracked sidewalk. There were no groceries in the cart. It was full of indeterminate junk, and Kevin realized the man was a wino.
Get away,
the wino screamed.
Get away, thief, fucking thief, fucking thief!
Kevin ran, darted across the street, more frightened of the man's madness than he was of the idea anyone might believe that he, Kevin, was a thief. The wino called after him.
This isn't Oakley. This is Hildesville. Get out of town, you fucking thief.
It was then that he realized that this town wasn't Oakley, or Hildesville, or any other town with a normal name. How could an utterly abnormal town have a normal name? Everything, streets, buildings, cars, signs, the few pedestrians,
was two-dimensional. Things had height, they had width, but they had no thickness. He passed a woman who looked the way Meg's ballet teacher might have looked if the ballet teacher put on 150 pounds. She was wearing slacks the color of bazooka bubblegum. Like the wino, she was pushing a shopping cart. It had a squeaky wheel. It was full of Polaroid Sun 660 cameras. She looked at Kevin with narrow suspicion as they drew closer together. At the moment when they passed each other on the sidewalk, she disappeared. Her shadow was still there, and he could still hear that rhythmic squeaking. But she was no longer there. Then she reappeared, looking back at him from her fat, flat, suspicious face. And Kevin understood the reason why she had disappeared for a moment. It was because the concept of a side view didn't exist, couldn't exist, in a world where everything was perfectly flat. This is Polaroidsville, he thought with a relief which was strangely mingled with horror. And that means this is only a dream. Then he saw the white picket fence, and the dog, and the photographer standing in the gutter. There were rimless spectacles propped up on his head. It was Pop Merrill.
Well, son, you found him,
the two-dimensional Polaroid Pop said to Kevin without removing his eye from the shutter.
That's the dog right there. The one tore up that kid out in Schenectady. Your dog is what I mean to say.
Then Kevin woke up in his own bed, afraid he had screamed, but more concerned at first, not about the dream, but to make sure he was all there, all three dimensions of him. He was. But something was wrong.
Stupid dream, he thought. Let it go, why can't you? It's over. Photos are burned, all 58 of them. And the cameras bust.
His thought broke off like ice as that something wrong, teased at his mind again. It's not over, he thought. It's not. But before the thought could finish itself, Kevin Delavan fell deeply, dreamlessly asleep. The next morning, he barely remembered the nightmare at all. The 2 weeks following his acquisition of Kevin Delavan's Polaroid Sun were the most aggravating, infuriating, humiliating 2 weeks of Pop Merrill's life. There were quite a few people in Castle Rock who would have said it couldn't have happened to a more deserving guy. Not that anyone in Castle Rock did know, and that was just about all the consolation Pop could take. He found it cold comfort. Very cold indeed, thank you very much. But who would have ever believed the Mad Hatters would have, could have, let him down so badly? It was almost enough to make a man wonder if he was starting to slip a little. God forbid. Back in September, he hadn't even bothered to wonder if he would sell the Polaroid. The only questions were how soon and how much. The Delavans had bandied the word supernatural about, and Pop hadn't corrected them, although he knew that what the Sun was doing would be more properly classed by psychic investigators as a paranormal rather than supernatural phenomenon. He could have told them that, but if he had, they might both have wondered how come the owner of a small-town used goods store and part-time usurer knew so much about the subject. The fact was this. He knew a lot because it was profitable to know a lot, and it was profitable to know a lot because of the people he thought of as my Mad Hatters. Mad Hatters were people who recorded empty rooms on expensive audio equipment, not for a lark or a drunken party stunt, but either because they believed passionately in an unseen world and wanted to prove its existence, or because they wanted passionately to get in touch with friends and or relatives who had passed on. Passed on. That's what they always called it. Mad Hatters never had relatives who did something so simple as die. Mad Hatters not only owned and used Ouija boards, they had regular conversations with spirit guides in the other world, never heaven, hell, or even the rest area of the dead, but the other world, who put them in touch with friends, relatives, queens, dead rock and roll singers, even arch-villains. Pop knew of a Mad Hatter in Vermont
who had twice-weekly conversations with Hitler. Hitler had told him it was all a bum rap. He had sued for peace in January of 1943. That son of a bitch Churchill had turned him down. Hitler had also told him Paul Newman was a space alien who had been born in a cave on the moon. Mad Hatters went to seances as regularly and as compulsively as drug addicts visited their pushers. They bought crystal balls and amulets guaranteed to bring good luck. They organized their own little societies and investigated reputedly haunted houses for all the usual phenomena. Teleplasm, table wrappings, floating tables and beds, cold spots, and of course, ghosts. They noted all of these, real or imagined, with the enthusiasm of dedicated bird watchers. Most of them had a ripping good time. Some did not. There was that fellow from Wolfboro, for instance. He hanged himself in the notorious Tecumseh House, where a gentleman farmer had, in the 1880s and 90s, helped his fellow men by day and helped himself to them by night, dining on them at a formal table in his cellar. The table stood upon a floor of sour, packed dirt, which had yielded the bones and decomposed bodies of at least 12 and perhaps as many as 35 young men, all vagabonds. The fellow from Wolfboro had left this brief note on a pad of paper beside his Ouija board. Can't leave the house. Door's all locked. I hear him eating. Tried cotton. Does no good.
And the poor deluded asshole probably thought he really did,
Pop had mused after hearing this story from a source he trusted. Then there was a fellow in Dunwich, Massachusetts, to whom Pop had once sold a so-called spirit trumpet for $90. The fellow had taken the trumpet to the Dunwich Cemetery and must have heard something exceedingly unpleasant because he had been raving in a padded cell in Arkham for almost 6 years now, totally insane. When he had gone into the boneyard, his hair had been black. When his screams awoke the few neighbors who lived close enough to the cemetery to hear them and the police were summoned, it was as white as his howling face. And there was the woman in Portland who lost an eye when a session with the Ouija board went cataclysmically wrong. The man in Kingston, Rhode Island, who lost three fingers on his right hand when the rear door of a car in which two teenagers had committed suicide closed on it. The old lady who landed in Massachusetts Memorial Hospital short of most of one ear when her equally elderly cat, Claudette, supposedly went on a rampage during a seance. Pop believed some of these things, disbelieved others, and mostly held no opinion. Not because he didn't have enough hard evidence one way or the other, but because he didn't give a fart in a high wind about ghosts, seances, crystal balls, spirit trumpets, rampaging cats, or the fabled John the Conqueror route. As far as Reginald Marion Pop Merrill was concerned, the Mad Hatters could all take a flying fuck at the moon. As long, of course, as one of them handed over some mighty tall tickets for Kevin Delavan's camera before taking passage on the next shuttle. Pop didn't call these enthusiasts Mad Hatters because of their spectral interests. He called them that because the great majority, he was sometimes tempted to say all of them, seemed to be rich, retired, and just begging to be plucked. If you were willing to spend 15 minutes with them nodding and agreeing while they assured you they could pick a fake medium from a real one just by walking into the room, let alone sitting down at the seance table, or if you spent an equal amount of time listening to garbled noises, which might or might not be words on a tape player with the proper expression of awe on your face, you could sell them a $4 paperweight for 100 by telling them a man had once glimpsed his dead mother in it. You gave them a smile, and they wrote you a check for $200. You gave them an encouraging word, and they wrote you a check for $2,000. If you gave them both things at the same time, they just kind of passed the checkbook over to you and asked you to fill in the amount. It had always been as easy as taking candy from a baby. Until now. Pop didn't keep a file in his cabinet marked Mad Hatters any more than he kept one marked Coin Collectors or Stamp Collectors. He didn't even have a file cabinet. The closest thing to it was a battered old book of phone numbers he carried around in his back pocket, which, like his purse, had over the years taken on the shallow, ungenerous curve of the spindly buttock it lay against every day. Pop kept his files where a man in his line of work should always keep them, in his head. There were 8 full-blown Mad Hatters that he had done business with over the years. People who didn't just dabble in the occult, but who got right down and rolled around in it. The richest was a retired industrialist named McCarty, who lived on his own island about 12 miles off the coast. This fellow disdained boats and employed a full-time pilot who flew him back and forth to the mainland when he needed to go. Pop went to see him on September 28th, the day after he obtained the camera from Kevin. He couldn't exactly think of it as robbery. The boy, after all, had been planning to smash it to shit anyway, and what he didn't know surely couldn't hurt him. He drove to a private airstrip just north of Booth Bay Harbor in his old but perfectly maintained car, then gritted his teeth and slitted his eyes and held on to the steel lockbox with the Polaroid Sun 660 in it for dear life as the Mad Hatter's beach craft plunged down the dirt runway like a rogue horse, rose into the air just as Pop was sure they were going to fall off the edge and be smashed to jelly on the rocks below, and flew away into the autumn empyrean. He had made this trip twice before, and had sworn each time that he would never get into that goddamn flying coffin again. They bumped and jounced along, with the hungry Atlantic less than 500 feet below, the pilot talking cheerfully the whole way. Pop nodded and said Aya in what seemed like the right places, although he was more concerned with his imminent demise than with anything the pilot was saying. Then the island was ahead, with its horribly, dismally, suicidally short landing strip and its sprawling house of redwood and fieldstone, and the pilot swooped down, leaving Pop's poor old acid-shriveled stomach somewhere in the air above them. And they hit with a thud, and then, somehow, miraculously, they were taxiing to a stop, still alive and whole, and Pop could safely go back to believing God was just another invention of the Mad Hatters, at least until he had to get back in that damned plane for the return journey.
"Great day for flying, huh, Mr. Merrill?"
the pilot asked, unfolding the steps for him.
"Finest kind,"
Pop grunted, then strode up the walk to the house where the Thanksgiving turkey stood in the doorway, smiling in eager anticipation. Pop had promised to show him
the goddamnedest thing I ever come across,
and Cedric McCarty looked like he couldn't wait. He'd take one quick look for form's sake, Pop thought, and then fork over the lettuce. He went back to the mainland 45 minutes later, barely noticing the thumps and jounces and gut-goozling drops as the beach hit the occasional air pocket. He was a chastened, thoughtful man. He had aimed the Polaroid at the Mad Hatter and took his picture. While they waited for it to develop, the Mad Hatter took a picture of Pop. And when the flashbulb went off, had he heard something? Had he heard the low, ugly snarl of that black dog? Or had it been his imagination? Imagination, most likely. Pop had made some magnificent deals in his time, and you couldn't do that without imagination. Still, Cedric McCarty, retired industrialist par excellence, and Mad Hatter extraordinaire, watched the photographs develop with that same childlike eagerness, but when they finally came clear, he looked amused and even perhaps a little contemptuous, and Pop knew, with the infallible intuition which had developed over almost 50 years, that arguing, cajolery, even vague hints that he had another customer just slavering for a chance to buy this camera, none of those usually reliable techniques would work. A big, orange, no-sale card had gone up in Cedric McCarty's mind. But why? God damn it, why? In the picture Pop took, that glint Kevin had spotted amid the wrinkles of the black dog's muzzle had clearly become a tooth. Except tooth wasn't the right word, not by any stretch of the imagination. That was a fang. In the one McCarty took, you could see the beginnings of the neighboring teeth.
Fucking dog's got a mouth like a bear trap,
Pop thought. Unbidden, an image of his arm
in that dog's mouth rose in his mind. He saw the dog, not biting it, not eating it, but shredding it, the way the many teeth of a wood chipper shred bark, leaves, and small branches. How long would it take? He wondered, and looked at those dirty eyes staring out at him from the overgrown face and knew it wouldn't take long. Or suppose the dog seized him by the crotch instead. Suppose... But McCarty had said something and was waiting for a response. Pop turned his attention to the man, and any lingering hope he might have held of making a sale evaporated. The Mad Hatter extraordinaire, who would cheerfully spend an afternoon with you trying to call up the ghost of your dear departed Uncle Ned, was gone. In his place was McCarty's other side, the hard-headed realist who had made Fortune magazine's listing of the richest men in America for 12 straight years. Not because he was an airhead who had had the good fortune to inherit both a lot of money and an honest, capable staff to husband and expand it, but because he had been a genius in the field of aerodynamic design and development. He was not as rich as Howard Hughes, but not quite as crazy as Hughes had been at the end either. When it came to psychic phenomena, the man was a Mad Hatter. Outside that one area, however, he was a shark that made the likes of Pop Merrill look like a tadpole swimming in a mud puddle.
Sorry, Pop said. I was wool-gathering a little, Mr. McCarty.
I said it's fascinating, McCarty said. Especially the subtle indications of passing time from one photo to the next. How does it work, camera in camera?
I don't understand what you're getting at.
No, not a camera, McCarty said, speaking to himself. He picked the camera up and shook it next to his ear. More likely some sort of roller device.